Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Ted Rosen. I am the attorney for the appellant in this case, Maura Robey, who was a respondent at the trial court, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if I could. We are here today to address the appeal that we've filed, and I'd like to focus today on two specific issues. The first issue is the trial court's adoption of the valuation that the joint expert John Connell performed of the party's jointly held business, Ready Razor Incorporated, which I'll refer to as RCI. And the second issue addresses the court's maintenance findings, and in particular, the court's determination of what the appellee's income was for purposes of the maintenance analysis. It's respectfully submitted that the trial court erred in both of these important issues. The trial court, with respect to the valuation issue that I'll address first, adopted a valuation technique in this case which is clearly contrary to Colorado law. And while I understand that trial courts have broad discretion when addressing valuation disputes, that discretion is not unbridled. It is not unfettered. The valuation determination has to be reasonable, and it has to be supported by competent facts. If not, then the trial court's valuation determination is an abuse of discretion. In this case, the technique that the court adopted, which Mr. Connell performed, was to average two different methodologies and determine that the value of the business was essentially simply the arithmetic average. The two methodologies were the capitalization of earnings methodology, and the second was the excess earnings methodology, or what Mr. Connell sometimes called the summation of assets methodology. There is no dispute in this case about what the appropriate standard was that Mr. Connell had to follow. Mr. Connell conceded it. Mr. Campbell, the rebuttal expert that appellant hired, also confirmed that standard, and that standard is found in Revenue Ruling 5960. That rule says that a valuator cannot simply average the results of two disparate valuation techniques, because the simple arithmetic evaluation does not accomplish any useful purpose. Rather, what Revenue Ruling 5960 says is the evaluator has to investigate the reason for these disparate results, try to identify the reason, and if possible, explain why the disparate results occurred, and then try to reconcile them in some manner. In this case, there is no dispute about what caused the outlier, and the outlier is significant. The valuation number returned by the CEM method, the capitalization of earnings method, was $1.8 million. The valuation methodology returned by the EEM was $3.8 million. That difference of $2 million is greater than the total valuation ascribed by the CEM methodology only. That's a substantial difference. Therefore, the evaluator was required to investigate the reason for the difference. Here, he did that, and there's no dispute about what was causing the outlier. The CEM method was incapable of ascribing any value to what Mr. Connell said was the large inventory that RCI held. And the reason why that is correct is because of this. The CEM method simply looks at the net income of a company and then applies a capitalization rate to that net income to determine what the value of the company is. Explicit in that, as Mr. Connell found, is because the inventory doesn't generate any income at all, then the CEM methodology doesn't ascribe any value to the inventory.
We go one step further and conclude that the value was a lot less than the book value because it tended to be bottles that were pre-marked with different companies, hotels or health clubs or whatever, and nobody other than those health clubs, the particular entity, would be interested in purchasing that inventory. So it wasn't inventory like if I had a whole fleet of Lamborghinis that could be resold. It was a very difficult inventory to sell at auction or in some kind of liquidation.
It was in part, Your Honor, that's correct. But the record shows, in the record, there's a large product brochure of RCI showing all of the products that it had for sale. And in the record, in both Mr. Connell's testimony and in the testimony of the accountant for the company, John Hughes, they both confirmed that the inventory wasn't limited to what suddenly became shorthanded as these little tiny bottles, but a wide variety of products like bathrobes and bath slippers and all sorts of other products that one would find in a spa. So while I agree that even though the company said and even though Mr. Connell said that its inventory was worth $3.5 million, and that's found in the company's financial statements and in Mr. Connell's Schedule 2 of his report, which is tab UU, and that's he used that schedule to come up with the excess earnings number that he did. That inventory was carried on the company's books at $3.5 million. And importantly, Your Honors, the company, every single year, and Mr. Connell and Mr. Hughes both confirmed this, wrote off what the company considered to be its obsolete inventory each and every year. So the $3.5 million that the company carried on its books as inventory in 2009 was a number that didn't reflect what the company itself said was obsolete. There is no dispute that the error in this case, according to us at least, was simply the adoption of the CEM method. And the interesting issue is Mr. Connell identified the inventory as being a reason that the CEM not only couldn't be applied in this case to properly value the company, but the CEM could not even be adjusted as Rule 5960 requires to try to normalize the outlier to come up with a value that reflected correcting the variable that was causing the inapplicability. The CEM could not be fixed, and that is directly from Mr. Connell's own testimony. So what we have here is a situation where you have two valuation methodologies with widely disparate results, one of them being incapable of recognizing the outlier and being adjusted in any way to reflect the value of the inventory at whatever level it might appropriately be valued at, whether it's $3.5 million as on the company's books or some other level, and simply saying, well, I'm just going to average the two and come out with a number. And I'll explain why that's contrary to Colorado law with this example. It's akin to someone walking into a doctor's office who thinks he or she weighs 160 pounds, and the doctor saying, well, get on this scale. And the scale, you step on and you look down and it says 40 pounds. And although you're probably pleasantly surprised by that, you know that that's incorrect. And the doctor says, well, step on this other scale with the slides and whatnot, a little more sophisticated scale, and you step on it and it says, oh, 160 pounds. The doctor cannot tell one that, okay, then I'm going to tell you that you weigh 160 plus 40 is 200 divided by 2 is 100. You weigh 100 pounds. Rather, what Revenue Ruling 5960 requires is the doctor to investigate why we've got these disparate results. And if it turns out that the scale that you just step on without the fancy stuff on top is set at a beginning point of, instead of zero, minus 120 pounds, then you figured out, oh, okay, I see what the problem is. And you can fix that by recalibrating the little dial on the scale so it points to zero, get back on, and you should have a result that's relatively close to 160 pounds. The other thing that helps us here is when we look at the valuation generated by the EEM of $3.8 million, we can cross-check that with other types of methodologies this court has approved of. A spouse in a divorce is entitled to their equitable portion of both the tangible and intangible value of the company. Here it was uncontroverted that the company had tangible value or book value of $3.1 million. Mr. Connell's report said that the company had goodwill of about $747,000. And if you add those two amounts together, you get approximately $3.8 million. That figure is within $50,000 of the EEM calculation that Mr. Connell had opined about. Thank you, and I'm going to reserve the rest of my time.
May it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Villanueva. I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Gary Robey. First of all, I think we need to clarify what the standard of review is for a business valuation. Although the division of property by a trial court is reviewable under the abuse of discretion standard, a finding as to a business valuation is a finding of fact subject to review only upon the clearly erroneous standard where there is no evidence in the record to support the trial court's finding. That's what Page, that's what Huff teaches. And in this case, the finding that the trial court made with respect to the value of RCI was exactly the opinion rendered by John Connell. Therefore, there's evidence in the record to support the trial court's finding as to the value of RCI. And to set aside factual findings, it's a very, very very tough standard. The trial court's finding as to the value of RCI was placed on it by, or was based upon the opinion of a jointly selected expert, John Connell, a highly respected professional, a preeminent accountant and forensic business valuator. So clearly, there was a competent expert rendering these opinions. And the attack on Mr. Connell here is really somewhat bizarre because Mr. Rosen has chosen not to make his own expert's testimony part of the record, and the attack consists entirely of his cross-examination and Mr. Connell's testimony itself. And Mr. Connell testified that his report was prepared in conformance with the statement of standards for valuation services, and he also testified that his report was prepared consistent with revenue ruling 59-60. There is no evidence before this court to suggest that it was not prepared in accordance with revenue ruling 59-60. He said that the opinion has been modified over the years and construed over the years, and his valuation was done consistent with the standards for business valuation published by the American Institute of CPAs and revenue ruling 59-60.
Villanueva, how did Mr. Connell respond to the argument that opposing counsel makes that you can't average these two methods?
Mr. Connell stated that he did not just simply or mechanically perform an average. He looked at this case from all different sides. This business valuation, because it took so long for this case to come to trial, the valuation basically was an ongoing process over nearly 2.5 years. He prepared multiple reports. He discussed them with the parties. He discussed them with Mr. Rosen. He discussed them with Mr. Campbell. He made a decision not to simply average, but he said, I've got this valuation here, I've got this valuation here. Neither one of them seems to fit I think that in my professional judgment, the most appropriate way to deal with this is to perform an average. But he did not simply and mechanically say, well, I got this number, I got that number, I'll just toss it up in the air and decide to do an average. I mean, he made a very studied, calculated, and conscious evaluation here and determined that the best value was what was in what was in between.
How did he respond to the assertion if it that you can't, under Revenue Ruling 5960, average these particular different valuations?
He said that it's not prohibited. He said that one of the preeminent experts in the field, Mr. Shannon Pratt, engaged in averaging, and that Revenue Ruling 59-60 does not broadly proscribe any type of averaging. He said that it's done all the time by very competent experts, including Shannon Pratt, who's, according to Mr. Connell, one of the most preeminent experts in the field. There has been no...
Counsel, can affect to say whether or not...
Yes, he
did. He could have assigned different weights. He could have given 80% to one and 20 to the other.
Yes, he did. He did use the term weighting in his testimony, and it wasn't again. It wasn't some simple process of, well, I'm going to just, you know, look at the two of these and average them. I mean, it was done after a great deal of thought, after consultation with Mr. Campbell, after consultation with the parties, after consultation with Mr. Rosen. I mean, he felt in his professional judgment that was the way it should be done, and he testified that his opinion was reached in conformance with Revenue Ruling 59-60, and there is no evidence before this court to suggest that it does not comply with Revenue Ruling 59-60.
Mr. Villanueva, let me go back to the standard of review then. So if the allegation is that the valuation method was incorrect, is that reviewed for clear error, or would that be an abuse of discretion? Because my understanding is evaluation method, a court has discretion to accept one over another.
Well, the trial court has the discretion to accept one method over another. But the finding that it reached, according to Page and according to Huff, is a finding of fact that is reviewable under the clearly erroneous standard. And frankly, business valuation is not an exact science. It requires a considerable amount of professional judgment. And Mr. Connell used his best professional judgment. He spent a great deal of time. He took into account the parties' various positions and all information that the parties and Mr. Campbell provided to him. And using his best professional judgment, he came up with a valuation. There's been no suggestion that he didn't spend enough time on this, or that he was sloppy, or hurried through it. There's no suggestion that he's incompetent, that he's corrupt, or that he displayed favoritism to either party. He testified that his opinion wasn't taken favorably by either party. Neither party liked his opinion. My client certainly felt the business was worth less, but Mr. Connell came up with what he did, and it is what it is. I do want to touch briefly on this issue of excess inventory, which Mr. Rosen continues to suggest is some big issue. It's really a red herring in this case. The evidence before the court was that there is a group of competitors who are not exactly the same as Mr. Roby's company, and that these competitors have a higher turnover of their inventory than does RCI. So people start throwing around this term excess inventory. The trial court itself in its findings said it really isn't excess inventory. Although Mr. Roby's company carries more inventory than its competitors because of the somewhat unique and peculiar nature of his business, he needed to carry that heavier or greater amount of inventory, and therefore there was not excess inventory, and Mr. Connell addressed that in his testimony as well. I've never seen an appellant succeed on an appeal by arguing that the trial court should have accepted their expert's report over another expert's report and not even have their own expert's testimony made part of the record. I know that Mr. Rosen didn't have time to address the issue of maintenance, but I would like to touch briefly on the issue of maintenance, if I could. And clearly, the award of maintenance is subject to the abuse of discretion standard. Abuse of discretion does not mean that you would have made the same findings had you been the trial court, or that, you know, you would have ruled differently. Abuse of discretion means that the trial court's decision was manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair. If the Colorado legislature would legislate maintenance guidelines, maintenance awards would be much easier to review. But the legislature has failed to do so, despite numerous bills having been proposed over the years. And the only guidelines that have ever been passed are guidelines with respect to temporary maintenance for people who make less than $6,250 per month combined gross income. And the statute, by its term, says that the temporary maintenance statute cannot be considered by the trial court in cases where the income is above that level or for permanent orders. In reviewing reported appellate decisions concerning maintenance, it is remarkable how few of your opinions give information as to the amount of maintenance that was awarded. And it seems pretty obvious to we practitioners that this court, as well as the Colorado Supreme Court, is consciously elected to do that, because you are not trying to set judicially by common law guidelines telling trial courts how much maintenance to award or for how long, because then all we would be having is judicially created guidelines when the legislature has chosen not to do so. Mr. Rosen's suggestion that you should tell the trial court to award $11,000 a month maintenance, which is basically like almost 80% of Mr. Roby's take-home or available income, is asking this court to go into uncharted territory.
Counsel, let me just ask a question about that. Did I understand that Mr. Roby's tax return for 2009 was like roughly $550,000? And so I think the income that was calculated for purpose of maintenance was like disregarded about $200,000 or so of that income. Can you explain the basis for that?
Mr. Roby, because RCI is an S corporation, has a considerable amount of what we call S corporation income that shows up on a tax return, even though it is not actually money that is paid to him. The only money that is paid that's an actual cash distribution over and above his salary of $25,000 per month is the payment of taxes on the S corporation distributions. So he testified, and we beat this issue into the ground in the 5 days of hearing that we had in this case. He testified that his monthly income was approximately $25,000, that he did not have any more cash. Judge Hannon accepted that. He made a finding as to that. The S corporation income obviously gets built up into the business and was factored into the business valuation. But in terms of available cash, Mr. Roby testified there was no dispute. Even if there was, Judge Hannon made a finding that he had $25,000 a month gross income and approximately $15,000 a month take-home income. Mr. Roby is paying $4,000 in child support, $4,000 in maintenance, $950 in child support, and although it's only a once a year property settlement payment, he's paying $52,000 or $53,000 per year, which equates to about $4,500 per month. So Ms. Roby is already getting approximately two-thirds or over two-thirds of Mr. Roby's take-home pay. She received maintenance for two and a half years before the permanent orders hearing. So it's not that she's only getting 4 years of maintenance. She is getting six and a half years of maintenance in a marriage that lasted approximately 18 years until the parties separated. Ms. Roby has considerable income without ever having to go out and work, and her testimony in court and the testimony of the vocational evaluator was really very unusual. I mean, you don't find many, you know, women who are willing to come into court and say, I don't have any intention of getting a job, you know, in the last 2.5 years. The only thing that I've done about getting a job is to take an online course to be a personal trainer, because that sounds like it might be interesting. But I may or may not do that. It depends how much maintenance the court awards me. She indicated to the court she really had no inclination to go out and work, although she did tell the vocational evaluator that she might be interested in being an interior designer. And so the trial court made a finding amply supported by, you know, Patrick Orbino's testimony and report that she was capable of making $3,300 a month. If you add that on to the other income that she has, she's actually got income well over $12,000 or $13,000 per month. And that's not counting, and I'm not saying count the property settlement, I'm saying count the interest on the property settlement, because that is income. You count the $4,000, and that's about, I think, $1,600 a month. You count the maintenance, that's another $4,000. She takes $10,000 a year out of her IRA, mandatory distributions. She could make $3,300 a month. I mean, you know, her income is not very much different from Mr. Roby's after the payment of maintenance. And the truth of the matter is, and we all have to accept this fact, you can't kill the goose that lays the golden egg. Mr. Roby's ability to pay maintenance, his ability to pay the property division, this ties into the argument about how, you know, Mr. Roby somehow should sell the business or hawk the business so that he could, you know, make a lump sum payment on the property division. Mr. Roby only has so much money available to him, as the trial court recognized. The trial court, under the circumstances, entered an award which we submit was equitable, reasonable, and fair under the circumstances, and in terms of the division of property, which the trial court made a finding that it was equitable, specifically made a finding, so we don't have to say it has to be equal. He said it's equitable. So we are looking here at the abuse of discretion standard, and I would respectfully submit to this court that the trial court's permanent orders were neither arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair, and the decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Your Honors, before turning to the maintenance issue, I'd like to just address the question raised by the court on 5960. 5960, by its own terms, which are cited in our opening brief, clearly states that no useful purpose can be served by simply averaging the arithmetic product of two different methodologies if those methodologies have generated widely disparate results. It's black and white, and Mr. Connell, in his testimony, conceded that. With respect to the issue about Mr. Campbell's testimony, Mr. Campbell's report is in the record as Exhibit TT. The party stipulated to the admission of both experts' reports. It wasn't necessary for this court to have his testimony. We're not saying that Mr. Campbell is right compared to Mr. Connell. What we're saying is Mr. Connell's report, under the applicable standard, is in error, and this court has the ability under existing case law to find under the abuse of discretion standard that it is so. With respect to maintenance, the appellee raised in its argument that I had deceived the court by asserting that the definition of income contained in the child support is properly looked at when considering maintenance. And if one actually reads the maintenance statute, 1410.114, and the subsection containing the importation clause, which is 1410.114.24a, it says that for purposes of this section, doesn't say for purposes of this subsection, for purposes of this section, income shall have the same meaning as the terms described in section 1410.115.3, which is that long child support definition of income. This court has held before, in the case of Howard versus Colorado Department of Revenue, 680 P. 2nd, 1336, that when the legislature has used the term section in a subsection of the section, the legislature intended its use of the word section to refer to the entire statute. And if the legislature had intended otherwise, it would have used the term subsection. So if the importation clause in the maintenance statute was designed only to apply to the subsection applicable to temporary maintenance, the legislature should have used and would have used the term subsection. And that's not parsing words, Your Honor, because if you look at the maintenance statute, it is littered with references to different subsections. So the use by the legislature of the term section, when it says for purposes of this section, the child support definition of income is what we're going to use, wasn't a mistake or in error. And that difference is substantial. The court in its order on the same page found that income for child support was approximately $46,000 a month. And then a few paragraphs below, it found that, well, gross income actually is $24,900 because Mr. Roby said that's what he actually got from the company. And he only has $14,500 of that available to him. I submit, Your Honor, that the starting place for the income figure, $46,000 compared to $24,900, is such a vastly different number that the trial court's refusal to use the child support income number in its maintenance calculation constitutes error that this court can review de novo because it's a legal determination. Thank you.
Both for your arguments this morning. Case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion.